Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument, National Union and Lexington versus Mead Johnson, Mr. Shafter.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Al Shaftel from the Cadwalader firm on behalf of the appellants, the Mead Johnson parties. We are before the Court on two appeals of judgments from summary judgments in two related insurance coverage cases. Both involve the same primary and excess carriers as plaintiffs seeking to avoid coverage obligations. Both involve the same underlying coverage, advertising liability, and coverage for false advertisement liability imposed on Mead Johnson. But they involve very separate coverage issues. Nonetheless, in both, the district court radically departed from governing Indiana law, both with respect to basic contract principles and basic insurance principles.
Radically?
Your Honor, with respect to the PBM, the first of the enumerated appeals, the insurers prevailed. District court granted summary judgment based on late notice.
Can you identify any Indiana cases that have actually found that an insured overcame the presumption of prejudice under circumstances comparable to this?
Judge, no case has been identified, but when I referenced before the radical departure, and I want to go back and emphasize it, from Indiana law.
Rather a radical departure in your interpretation of the insurance agreement. Your failure to distinguish between subsection A and B and C. Notification to Stryker is just for occurrences, not for suits.
Your Honor, with respect to the customized notice provision, the heading of the endorsement.
Look, it's very clear. The amendment that requires notification for the risk manager is limited to occurrences. It couldn't be clearer.
Both A, relating to occurrences, speaks in terms of as soon as practicable. It defines as soon as practicable with reference to the Director of Insurance, Mr. Stryker.
Mr. Shaftel, this is not going to be a useful use of your time to argue about that endorsement. I agree with Judge Posner. It is very clear.
Judge, get back to what I do see as a departure from Indiana governing precedent, the two-prong test, going back to the Supreme Court 1984 Miller v. Diltz, speaks of even if notice is late.
They wanted you to produce some documents to them in order that they could, you know, evaluate for the litigation whether they could have done anything if they had represented you. So, and why didn't you turn over the documents?
I think consistent with the record, we did. What both the Barringer deposition testimony, the affidavits, and the insurer's own claims.
So you produced all the documents they asked you for? Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, there were confidential.
That's a yes or no question. You produced all the documents they asked for?
We did not.
Yes or no? That's a very simple question.
Judge, we did not.
And why not?
It falls into two or three categories. One, they sought attorney-client privilege documents, which we and I believe the magistrate judge below agreed they were not entitled to. Two, and this may be equally...
The magistrate judge ruled on all the document requests. So the documents you didn't turn over were pursuant to his rulings.
That is correct.
Yes or no?
That is correct, Your Honor, as part of the discovery.
So you only refused to turn over documents that the magistrate judge said you didn't have to turn over?
That is correct, Your Honor. There were other documents governed by a confidentiality agreement with PBM, which we never refused to turn over. And this is it's in the record in several places. We could not turn them over until the carriers signed on to the confidentiality stipulation. So it is a red herring, this argument that we failed to somehow cooperate, which is not part of the late notice defense, I think, on this appeal. We were willing and able to turn over the documents subject to attorney-client privilege. It was the insurers dragging their feet.
Let me ask you a different question. Why didn't you just notify National Union and Lexington?
We did not notify them earlier for two reasons. One is the reading of the notice provisions.
No, and two, this is a different question. Whether or not you were required to, why didn't you? You have insurers. Why didn't you notify them?
After the initial successes in the underlying litigation, there was not as...
Now, wait a minute. Why didn't you notify them when you were sued?
There was no view that the insurance coverage was going to be implicated. There was
You thought you were going to win?
We did.
And so you didn't bother to call the insurer that has... Okay.
We did judge, and in fact,
you
in the preliminary...
You had a 100% chance of winning?
That's not in the record. I don't, you know, it's hard to imagine there's 100%.
If you say yes, I'm really going to think you're out of your mind.
But what does the risk manager do at Mead Johnson if he doesn't get notice of a suit of this magnitude? I know he's busy with other things, but you would think everything would funnel to the risk manager.
Here the risk manager received notice post-verdict.
Right.
If the carriers, there's a contract here.
Wait a second. You guys knew when you were sued. So why didn't you tell Stryker?
There was not.
In fact, he must have known. You're a risk manager and your company is sued for $500 million. You learn about that.
Judge, as is in the record, he was not a full-time risk manager. There is nothing in the contract which was violated by his duties.
Now, wait a second. Johnson had it. You don't even have a – you've got a $2.5 billion, whatever size company you are, you don't have a risk manager?
Judge, Mead Johnson.
Part-time? How many hours does he spend risk managing?
Judge, Mead Johnson had recently been spun off within that year, I believe was the calendar. So there was structural transformation. And even assuming, okay, accepting the notice was late.
By structural transformation.
The risk
manager vanished in the transformation?
Prior to the transformation, Mead Johnson had no independent risk manager. It was the risk manager at the parent company. So there was a corporate change with personnel. And
you
at this,
forgot to have to appoint a risk manager.
One, you know what makes Indiana law
makes sense of what's going on in Mead Johnson from these briefs.
Your Honor, where...
He had to know, even if he's just a part-time risk manager. You're called risk manager. Your company is sued for $500 million. You don't learn about it? I don't get it.
It is uncontroverted in the record. Again, he was not a full-time...
I don't believe it for a moment.
Except Mead Johnson had been hit for $41 million and $4.5 million in two similar proceedings not too long before this, right? So you think risk would be something they'd be very concerned about.
Judge, in two proceedings, yes, similar I would take issue with. Different advertisements, different processes in place. And what is critical, within 10 days of the filing of the PBM suit, Mead Johnson defeated the preliminary injunction. There was no likelihood of success. There was a judicial finding of
no
literal
likelihood.
Falsity.
No likelihood of success was
zero.
The finding.
Correct. In terms of the defeat of the preliminary injunction motion.
The district judge found there was no likelihood of success.
The likelihood of success prong was not met by the PBM plaintiff, if I did not articulate that with too many negatives before. But accepting lateness, where the court below went very astray, was in ignoring the prejudice calculation.
Wait a second. I still don't understand. Forget about Stryker. you've got the insurance company, you pay premiums, the two insurance companies. Why didn't you tell them we've been sued and we'd like your help? They provided counsel for you in your previous suits, didn't they?
There was payment. There was prior insurance coverage litigation with the carriers over these previous suits, but there was ultimate payment through the litigation process.
So why wouldn't you want them to pay for the defense of this suit?
This suit or the suit that's before the court would be a cleaner, far cleaner case, obviously, if Mee Johnson had given notice earlier. But the law here speaks in terms of prejudice.
I'm not asking you about the law. Why, as a matter of business common sense, if you have insurance, you've paid for it, you've been represented before by them, you've accepted the lawyers they chose to defend the cases earlier, why didn't you just tell them?
In hindsight?
No. Why didn't you tell them? Why didn't Mee Johnson tell them?
It was a combination of the personnel overseeing the litigation, having confidence in the case, the risk manager.
I don't get it. You can have all the confidence in the world. The point is you have an insurance company which is going to represent you, and it's going to pay, I guess, up to $2 million in the case of National Union. You've paid for that service. Why don't you want it?
Your Honor, it would be easier if Mee Johnson had the same reading of the notice provision as you have articulated, but all of this begs the
question. I don't care whether it's notice is required. Why didn't they do it? Because they have this policy. It's worth $2 million to at least plus attorney's fees. So why don't they notify them?
It
doesn't commit them to anything, right? If they don't like what National Union wants to do in defense, they don't have to follow it. But why don't they just tell them?
You've insured us. reiterate.
Is there anything in the record about a reason for Mee Johnson's really peculiar behavior?
Judge, I think the record bespeaks of the two reasons I've tried to articulate. The litigate.
They're not reasons. They're not reasons.
Explanations.
They are reasons why you are arguing that Mee Johnson didn't violate the insurance agreement. They're not reasons why it would make any sort of sense for Mee Johnson not to notify its insurance companies.
Mr. Schaffel, I'd like to ask you about the other litigation, the consumer litigation, and specifically how our prior decision in the BASF case applies to that. As I understand, in that case, the theory of monopolization that was articulated, in essence, was that the insured party had disparaged the products of competitors. That was the method of monopolization. And so that looks an awful lot like the issues that are presented here. To agree with you, would we have to conclude that Illinois and Indiana law are simply different on this issue?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. I believe that BASF, similar to the First Circuit case as well, speaks about expanding coverage for paradigmatic antitrust claims. That was the language from the case. And although disparagement was one of the anti-competitive acts alleged, the court stated, not my interpretation, but the court stated, it was an antitrust case. And under Universal Curtis and others, those are not insurable. The consumer cases here could not have been more closely tethered.
So we would have to, in essence, rewrite the reasoning of BASF to agree with you. I mean, the opinion's pretty clear about for this coverage to apply, the false statements have to have been made about the underlying plaintiff. Right.
Your Honor, I believe the BASF case was in a very different context. I read it as actually supportive of Mead Johnson's position, because the issue that the court was addressing there and the concern that the court articulated was we can't expand insurance coverage under the guise of disparagement into antitrust matters. There's not a syllable in the consumer complaints below which speak about antitrust or monopoly or super competitive prices. To the contrary.
In this case, economic damage. But the only thing you have going for you is that the term arising under is vague, right? So you want to expand it, whereas the simplest interpretation, especially since it's preceded by injury arising from. That sounds like injury caused by. If it's just injury caused by, then you're out of luck.
Your Honor, I noticed the traffic light. If I could just address the last question. Thank you. I don't believe we're giving a broad but a fair construction consistent with the cases to what arising under means. And what the district court did below is read the advertising liability coverage to say, and it does not, we will cover claims or we will cover causes of action for disparagement. That's not what that's not the contract the insurers wrote. It's not the contract my client bargained for. They bargained for a contract, and they're a consumer-oriented company in terms of their business. They
and bargained. They've been repeatedly proven to have been misleading mothers and fathers about how good the product is for their babies, right? That's what this is all about.
Your Honor, there have been findings against them.
Claiming special health benefits that are non-existent in the evidence.
There's been findings for them, against them. The district court in the PBM case found no literal falsity.
No literal falsity is a pretty narrow ledge to cling to. I've handled Mead Johnson, Abbott Labs advertising disputes before. I imagine Judge Tinder has. We're both from Indiana. I'm sure Judge Posner's seen it. This is a long-term war in this industry. But claiming the moral high ground here is not the easiest thing for your client to do.
Your Honor, I do not mean to claim the moral high ground, although I think legally we do claim the merits. If there are other defenses the insurers want to raise at trial about knowledge and pre-knowledge about the advertisements or anything else, let the trier of fact determine that. Here we're on the issue of prejudice for lateness.
Another question about you. You say that, you know, your lawyers did a great job and so on and couldn't have done, but no, insurance companies couldn't have done better, couldn't have saved any money for you. But did you actually present evidence of this?
I believe the record supports that, Judge. This is a lawyer in law.
Evidence, like an expert witness?
We're not in expert discovery, but the two forms of evidence that I would present, and I think there are others we cite, one, there's a lawyer who these insurers have retained before. Two, $13.5 million is a lot of money in any neighborhood. It's also 300 times less, if I've done my arithmetic correctly, with the settlement, the price of admission for a settlement discussion that PBM made.
300? No, you have not done your math correctly.
They said 41.5.
Yes. Yes.
No, that's a third.
You still have the point, but it's not 300 times less.
I did pursue law, at least for the time being, rather than mathematics. But the last point, Your Honor, and the cases speak to this as a probative prong. The insurers were on the risk, were on notice for 17 months. I do believe the arithmetic is 70% of the time period of the litigation, the PBM case from beginning to appellate end. 70%, 17 months. In all that time, not one comma, let alone one substantive argument, did they change, edit, suggest. We do believe, Your Honor, that the record shows this case was skillfully handled. I know there could be sound bites. Jury verdict 13.
Why should they have done anything of that? Why should they have incurred any expenses to help you when they didn't think they insured you?
Your Honor,
they hadn't received timely notice.
Even after notice, they did not disclaim coverage. They reserved their rights.
What difference does it make? I don't understand.
I believe the law we cite to the court, they, after they received notice but without disclaiming, they did bear exposure. We were cooperating with them. There's no, we would submit, based on the record.
They didn't think that they owed you anything because you hadn't given them timely notice. So given that, why would they go out and pay legal fees in order to provide you with advice when they didn't think they had any liability to?
And risk estoppel arguments if they joined in.
There was no adjudication. We obviously took the position they did owe us coverage. And if a jury wants to say, I'm wrong, that in fact they had all these great ideas to have better handled the case, that they could have prevailed on appeal.
No, but you have the burden of proof. And that's why I asked you about whether you actually presented any evidence as opposed to argument and conjecture. It's like an expert, like a lawyer, someone not connected with any of these parties, who would say, well, you know, nothing the insurance company could have done, especially National Union with its limited liability.
I believe the actual facts in the record speak louder than an expert after the fact, although we've not hit the point of expert discovery.
So what are the facts in the record on that?
The Mee Johnson lawyers prevailed at the preliminary injunction stage.
That's so pathetic. Honestly.
If I could ask one more question. Mr. Shaftel, I frankly, from the briefing, had some concerns about this issue about whether the summary judgment might have been premature because of the pending discovery disputes. And I believe you told us in your briefs that those summary judgments had been issued without ruling on your on the insurer's Rule 72 objections to the discovery that you wanted. It looks to me as if, I think it was in the 161 case, December 11th, 2012, Judge Young sustained National Union's Rule 72A objections on your motion to compel in the related case. Obviously, these were all pulled together. It looks to me like he ruled on it. Could you explain your statement in your brief to me, please?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the consumer, what I'm referring to as the consumer case. Shortly before the summary judgment ruling that month, he sustained the insurer's objection to the magistrate judge's discovery order with respect to some documents. I believe there were other objections relating to deposition testimony which had not been resolved.
Those are nuances that don't seem to appear in your brief. It looks to me like the judge ruled. But we'll examine. I frankly think both sides have written briefs that seem to assume we don't check the records. That's not a very prudent way to practice in this court.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Shaftel.
Thank you.
Ms. Michaelides.
May it please the Court, Barbara Michaelides from Bates Carey Nicolides on behalf of the insurers. Also with me from my office is Bridget Curry, who assisted on the brief. I'd like to start, obviously, on the late notice issues. I think the Court understands our position perfectly about what provisions actually apply, what the duties impose upon Mee Johnson. or giving the carriers notice, and that the district court here properly found that notice was not properly given. I think there is no Indiana case law that would find that the insured overcomes prejudice where
there's a pretty good argument, however, that the Indiana Court of Appeals has just been rebelling against what the Indiana Supreme Court has been saying in this area. The Supreme Court has repeatedly made clear this presumption is rebuttable. The Indiana Court of Appeals keeps saying, no, it hasn't been rebutted. What kind of evidence would an insured need to provide to rebut the evidence of prejudice?
Well, I've thought long and hard about that. I mean, I think these late notice cases are on a continuum. And I think part of the problem is articulating a single standard that applies along
the
continuum.
How about an example? Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm trying to think of one. I think short of the insurer acknowledging a lack of prejudice, I don't believe, saying that we got a good result, Reichert rejects that directly. There was a not guilty, and the court still found the deprivation of the ability to participate, which is what the policy protects, is still prejudicial. So,
well, that's what the Court of Appeals said. How do you if your position is the presumption can't be rebutted unless the insurance company admits it has been rebutted, you can't reconcile that with the Supreme Court's decisions.
It's difficult. I go back to Miller, though. Miller involved three different cases. One of those cases was the Kasanovich case. That case involved summary judgment being awarded to the insurer. It was reversed on appeal. It went up to the Supreme Court. Notice was first given in that case post-trial, and the Supreme Court reversed and reinstated summary judgment for the insurer, notwithstanding its statement that there's a rebuttable presumption. So I think there is an inherent conflict, and I think
so
there
Miller,
are certain...
So Miller doesn't make any sense? Is that it's internally inconsistent?
No, I think what Miller is doing is trying to set the standard on the continuum.
Why can't the insured present expert testimony, some very experienced lawyer, has no connection with anybody, who says the insured hired, you know, terrific lawyers and nobody could have done any better. In fact, they hired better lawyers than the insurance company would have hired. And so there was no harm. What's wrong with that?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's only one prong of the analysis.
Oh,
okay, there was competent counsel.
If expert witnesses convincingly testify that there's no way that the insurance company could have helped the insured, why isn't that sufficient?
Because the insurers also have the right.
So you're really arguing that there is no rebutting this presumption. That's what you're saying. You can't think of any basis except insurers' acknowledgement, confession, on the basis for rebutting the presumption. That can't be right.
Well, because once you're...
No, that can't be right. Because the courts say it's a rebuttable presumption. You can't deny, honestly.
Well, I think the evidence I've come up with is
the lawyers.
The evidence that I've come up with, okay, say we have good lawyers. What about opportunities missed to try to settle?
You do not acknowledge the possibility of rebutting this presumption other than a confession by the insurer. If that's your position, it's contrary to the law.
Well, my position, I was saying, I am trying to think of what I think would
is
work.
That your position? Yes or no?
Yes, what about the opportunity to settle? It's not just lawyers. It's the opportunity to settle.
Get it? Yes, of course, an opportunity to settle. But your position is no evidence can rebut the presumption. Period. Only an acknowledgement by the insurer.
And even with the opportunity to settle, I understand that problem. And insurers want to manage things, and
right.
maybe you could have gotten a better result. There's always room to make that kind of speculative argument. Here, though, we've got evidence that was at PBM was saying that Mead Johnson's opening offer would have to be more than three times as much as they ultimately wound up paying. So it's a little hard to see an opening for a settlement.
Well, I think litigation is so fluid. I've been involved in many cases where the opening demands are crazy, and as the case progresses, there becomes opportunities later on to settle. That's all looking back in hindsight.
For less than $2 million?
Well, I don't know here. I think we're speculating.
Right?
Excuse me?
Yeah, you're National Union.
Yes.
So you have just a $2 million exposure.
Right.
Plus attorney's fees.
Right.
How do you think you could possibly get out of this for less than $2 million when you add the demands of the plaintiff to the attorney's fees you'd have to incur?
Well, I didn't say that we could definitely get out for $2
million. $2 million will be eaten up in attorney's fees.
My point is that we're speculating. This is the problem.
What were the attorney's fees you paid for in their last suits? By this PBM?
They were significant. I don't remember the exact dollar amount. It's in the brief.
Is that in the record?
I believe it is, yes.
So was Paul Hastings?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They were probably significant.
Yeah, that is very significant. There's no doubt. Mm-hmm. My point is that we're speculating again. This isn't evidence. You can't go back and say we would have had opportunities we didn't have.
How could you have gotten out of this at a cost of less than $2 million when you add their claims, which turned out to be worth $13.5 million, plus the attorney's fees you would have borne, which would have been considerable.
I'm not saying we could have gotten out for $2 million. We also had the excess policy, the Lexington policy. I'm saying
no,
there
I'm
may have been opportunities
National Union.
To
I'm
settle.
Not talking about Lexington. It's
well, I'm saying National Union standing
greater.
Alone probably would not have gotten out for under $2 million,
right.
Given a $13 million verdict. That
well, so why shouldn't it why shouldn't it be dismissed as the plaintiff?
Because we're looking in hindsight again, and the point
well,
is...
wait a second. You've just said it probably wouldn't. You just said and National Union. I mean, yes, Lexington, obviously, what, $25 million limit, but not National Union. So why shouldn't National Union have gotten a judgment?
Because there is the...
You
have rights under the policy.
You give me a theory as to which National Union gets out from... With an expense of less than $2 million.
I haven't posited that theory. I don't think in hindsight
well,
that
if you don't have
right.
any reason to think that they could get out of less than $2 million, you're conceding their position.
No, I'm not.
Of course you are.
I'm not. The policy...
You can't give the remotely plausible... You haven't even thought about it.
I have thought
you
about it.
You cannot articulate... Okay, you know, you explain to me a theory under which National Union gets out of this business for less than $2 million.
I said I don't think that is very – would have been likely at all. My point is that the policy provides these rights to the insurer, National Union, to participate in the defense.
Saying after trial that those rights are irrelevant,
you're just voiding the notice provision from the policy.
You've just conceded their argument. Not likely at all.
That is the reality. I mean, that is the reality. This was a high-stakes litigation that does not obviate the claim of prejudice.
Your only argument, which is hopeless, really hopeless, is that this presumption cannot be rebutted. So you agree it has been rebutted. There's no way National Union could have gotten out of this for less than $2 million. But to you, that makes no difference, doesn't require evidence, anything like that, because you think this is an irrebuttable presumption.
That's not at all what I said. I believe that these notice provisions
provide... It's irrebuttable because you don't accept any proof that would rebut it except acknowledgement by the insurance company.
I've not seen proof in this case of any evidence whatsoever to rebut
you
the presumption.
Proof doesn't matter.
I didn't say that.
Of
I said we haven't seen it here.
You didn't say that. You said the only thing that rebuts the presumption is an acknowledgement by the insurer. Now, if you want to withdraw that and explain to us what other evidence would rebut it, fine.
Well, I was trying to go along. I think you'd need more than a good result at trial. Reichert says you need more than that. You would need something more than speculation to say that there would have been no opportunity to settle the case.
What?
Well, in my own head, I'm thinking, how is it evidence as opposed to speculation? Everything I'm saying is pure speculation when you're looking back in the rearview mirror.
In this case, what would be convincing evidence?
To prove that there was no opportunity to settle?
What would be convincing evidence to rebut the presumption?
We started there. I've not, in my head, come up with anything that's evidentiary as opposed to pure speculation when you tender notice post-trial. Well, you would have to have expert testimony. I think you'd have to have some documentary proof that there was no ability to settle, and I'm not sure you could ever do that after trial.
To settle for less than $2 million?
Or to settle within the limits of combined policies, because we have Lexington as well.
I'm talking just about National Union.
And what about the opportunity to control the defense, participate in the defense?
What good would that do?
That does a lot of good. My clients typically and routinely participate in defense.
But it would cost you more than $2 million in attorney's fees to have won the case.
But that is their right under the policy, to participate and contribute to the defense, set strategy, choose experts. There are plenty of things they can do.
Defend the case successfully. How can that be your position is as incomprehensible as the suggestion that the risk manager, Mead Johnson, never learned about the litigation. I don't think I've ever.
I disagree with you.
A case in which the two opposing lawyers were so unreasonable.
You have to look
at
the.
I was totally unaware of their unreasonableness.
I think you have to look at the rights afforded under the policy before you can. You cannot isolate one single thing. There are a multitude of rights afforded under the policy that notice first given after the verdict.
If it would have cost you more than $2 million to handle this case for them, how have you been hurt?
By all the things I've told you.
No,
by
that's
being precluded from participating
injured
in the defense. That is an injury.
There's non-monetary injury?
No, but the thing is, you get to participate in the defense as the insurer. You get
but
to
you
try to posture it favorably
you get
for
out
settlement.
Of this for less than $2 million.
I didn't say I said it seems unlikely with the result that we have now after the fact. I'm not willing to concede that was impossible.
After the fact, you learn that you're better off not having handled the case, but you still want some sort of judgment against them. You have no injury. You have negative injury. They saved you money, and you're suing them.
Well, they're seeking coverage under the policy, and we're saying that we did not get the notice.
They're seeking $2 million, and if they'd given you notice and you'd handled the case, it would have cost you more than $2 million. So they did you a favor.
Well, they're seeking defense and indemnity costs. So, I mean, we have indemnity. We have Lexington. Both carriers have a stake in this litigation. I think you can't ignore Lexington. Well, if the court would, I'm running low on time, but I would like to hit at least the consumer class claim. I think BASF is directly on point. It is in Illinois law. I don't think there is an appreciable distinction between Indiana law and Illinois law. I think the same fundamental issues are in this case. What we have here are the consumers complaining that they paid too much money for the Mead Johnson products, which is exactly what the plaintiffs were complaining about in BASF, that they overpaid for Synthroid. And under the policy, which requires that the injury arise out of or be because of the personal or advertising injury, we cannot meet that standard here because there is no actionable defamation alleged by the underlying consumer plaintiffs.
Well, no, there is disparagement of a person's product. It's very broad language.
Right, but it's not of these plaintiffs. These plaintiffs were not
True.
Complaining that they were disparaged.
True, but that's not what the language says. It doesn't require of the claiming person's product. It's disparagement of a person's product.
Well, that's what trade disparagement is, but that claim is owned by the party that was disparaged. These
like
consumer plaintiffs. Well, arising out of is broad, but it's not limitless, certainly. And the courts that have considered it, including BASF and RISO, have said that that just is too causally attenuated for it to arise out of a covered event.
I have some concerns about that reasoning, though, because the parent consumers here are sort of the most obvious victims of the alleged wrongdoing by Mead Johnson, right?
Yes, they overpaid for the formula.
They overpay for the formula. Whether they're entitled to emotional damages for preying on their insecurities about their children's intellectual growth is a different question. But I mean those are the dynamics of the market for this infant formula. I don't exactly see kind of a vast vista of horribles coming if we were to recognize coverage in this situation.
Well, I think the policy is clear that it only responds to damages because of. So the question is, are there damages because of any trade disparagement
I would
to
say
PBM?
There's a pretty good argument that the parents' willingness to pay extra for Mead Johnson is not only foreseeable, but the intended result of the product disparagement here, right?
On behalf of Mead Johnson,
yes.
Vis-a-vis PBM.
That's what Mead Johnson was trying to accomplish.
Yeah, they're trying to maintain their market share at the expense of their competitors. Clearly, that's...
And keep their prices high. Mm-hmm.
Right. But I think what we're doing, you know, the coverage here, coverage B form, these are limited offense-driven coverages. And so you need to really have coverage responding to a covered offense. And courts who have looked at that have carefully determined that you have to limit it to trade disparagement. So had there been the competitor suing for the disparagement of their own product, that's what this coverage is intended to respond to. And I think the BASF court correctly recognized that if you were to start now looking at purely economic injury by consumers, you've unmoored the coverage determination from the actual allegations of the underlying complaint.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Shaftel, you had extra time, so we'll move on to our next argument. Thank you.